Welcome to Afterlives of Ancient Egypt, in which we discuss ancient history and relevant current events. I'm Kara Cooney, and I love to take deep dives into history that are not always possible in academic formats. So let's get started.
Hello, everyone.
Hello, hello.
How are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm behind on like six things, as Amber knows, and they're all like, you know, reviews of articles or articles that I must write myself. So I'm behind on everything as usual, but getting ready to go to England next week for a coffins conference in Cambridge. And that should be fun, run by Helen Strudwick. And I'll present some of my royal cache work there and announce the printing of the book, Recycling for Death. So that's great. Yeah, everything's going well. You know, UCLA all quiet on the Western Front, but let's see what the Eastern Front looks like.
That's exciting though about your book and everything.
Yeah,
yeah, awesome.
And meeting with graduate students about dissertations, which is really fun. Look at your face. Oh my God, dear listeners, Jordan's face just moved into a grimace.
It was a cringe.
Extraordinary proportions. And you know what? It's funny, meeting with everyone. Everyone is freaking out. There is no harder thing to do to write this book and this first book. And, you know, I'm there to be like, you need an appendix. Where's your data? You should put that in. What about this? We should meet, Jordan, as we do this live on.
I think I have too many appendices. I have so many.
But that's okay.
I guess it's better.
It's good to show your data, especially in a dissertation. What you do for the book and that printing is a different thing.
Yeah.
But for your dissertation, showing all your data is lovely. I think it's great.
That's what, I mean, we can talk more, but essentially I ended up having to split a chapter because like 100 single space pages, I think, was too much. So I made two.
Damn, girl.
So
that's a lot.
I have 10 tier chapters, but it's fine.
That's
I think my issue is going to be to be like, this doesn't need to be addressed, right? But it's fine.
Okay. It's a good problem to have.
I was going to say, it's an okay problem to have.
Yeah. So,
but yeah. And I find, though it's taking, you know, I feel like I make no progress every day when I write and all this stuff. I was telling Vilika this, like, the more you get into it, I find the easier it is. And it's still fun and enjoyable. It's more just the looming deadlines is the stressor. But like the writing of it is still fine and fun to go through the material and find new things as you're working through it again and all that kind of stuff. So,
well, because the writing is so mechanical and you think, oh, I've got it outlined, so I just have to write it.
Exactly.
But by writing it, you come up with the ideas that you didn't know before, and you don't know that until you write it.
And you figure out your process more. Like, I remember when I was younger in the program, I was talking to older graduate students about like how they do research and writing and stuff. And some were like, oh, I do all the research first and then I write. And I've come to the conclusion that that's not how I work at all. Like I have to kind of do it at the same time as I'm going, because then I forget things. Like I can't read stuff and then remember it from 2 months ago. Like you want to talk about Biden's memory? Like my memory is so bad. Like it needs to be contemporaneous with what I'm doing, or otherwise I like don't remember anything. So
I think I'm very similar, Jordan, and I'll go back and read things that I wrote. I'm like, look at me, so clever. And
I know, me too. I'm
then.
Like, oh my God, look at you.
And
like, you already
gone.
Did all this research. It's like, out of my brain.
I need to like sit
or
down
I go to the library
weeks.
And it's like, you have all these books that you ILL'd or whatever. And I go pick them up and I'm like, what did I want this for?
Yeah, why did I get this book? What is
and
this for?
I should write myself notes, like requested book for blah, but I don't. And then I'm like sitting there looking through this hieratic inscriptions thing. And I'm like, why did I request this book?
It's for a footnote, I'm sure.
It was like Dira Medina text or something. I was wanted to read one in translation. And I was like, this before, but it took me a while to figure it out. And I was like, Brussels, Ostraca from Brussels, like what? And
it could be, it's not figural, what you're looking for?
No, it was a text. I was collating all the Dira Medina, again, one of my appendices, collating all the Dira Medina, Ostraca, and papyri that talk about textiles and kind of categorizing them. By
it's
like
great.
Trade or lists or whatever. And one of them had a very interesting account of wages. And I wanted to look at the specific words being used and stuff.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So
I can't wait.
Yes.
So great.
Good, good. Okay. But today we're doing something more fun than my dissertation, probably for everyone else, and doing our February Q&A. And so a lot of these questions are actually from last month because we had too many, but we also have some new ones. So we'll be answering both. And before we begin, I did want to start with one question from a newer Patreon, Samuel, who sent us an amazing, beautiful question about animal rights and animal welfare and their own work. Actually, a Google Doc of their own work on the subject. And so we were very interested in this topic. And so instead of answering that question today that I think is more in depth, we're going to actually make it a standalone episode. So we'll be getting to that in the near future. But thank you, Samuel, for sending in all that. It's a really interesting topic. And I think we'll have to do some research and get back to you on that. And I think a lot of people will enjoy kind of see how the Egyptians treated animals, thought about animals, animal welfare, animal-human interaction. I know there's been some work done within the Greco-Roman worlds about animals as marginalized, hidden labor, and trying to give more voice to animals within as labor. So maybe we can kind of take that route with the Egyptian evidence as well. So,
as far as I know, and I haven't really looked, there's not a ton of writing about sentience or rights of animals, and more catalogs of the birds, catalogs of, you know, the Patrick Houlihan kind of work. You know, here are all the animals, and here's how they're listed, and discussions of wild versus domesticated, how they're depicted, how they're seen as part of society, human society, or problematic for human society, like the pig or the gazelle. Not that the pig isn't domesticated, but it's problematic, it seems. So things like that. But in terms of animal agency or humans taking away animal agency, that, you know, I haven't seen things directly touching on those, but maybe we'll find some stuff. So that's pretty cool.
All right. So let's get started. Our first question is from Lexi, and she asks, what ancient Egyptian pharaoh or person, excluding the ones you've already wrote on, Kara, would you make an HBO show for and why?
Well, you know, I've talked about this. Excluding the ones I've already written about, I would make an HBO show about so many.
I know.
But I think the one that I'm, and we're talking about Egyptian women, not Nubian women, I'm obsessed with Nojmet right now. And I think she's the one that's on the brain. She's as badass as you get. And she rules like a woman must within a very complicated patriarchal expression of crisis. She marries two Libyan warlords in succession. And there is much Egyptological disagreement about this. And many say Nojmet just means the sweet one. It's like being named sweetheart, sweetie. There must have been more than one, people say. But to have Herihor and Pyonk, not in that order, or Pyonk and Herihor, and there's disagreement there about what order they were in, right, amongst Egyptologists. But that both of them were married to a woman named Nojmet seems to me too much. Synchronicity. I think that this was the same woman, and that she was very young when she was married to Pyonk, and then was a more mature woman when she was married to Herihor. And then as Herihor became king, he then took on a harem and had many children in addition to the children he had with her. There's only one son, it seems, with her. But she's like the linchpin to the old Ramessid regime, the old dynasty, the way that you can domesticate, if you like, these two Libyan outsiders and bring them into the Egyptian fold. She was almost certainly an educator of how things should have been done. She was a diplomat. And if you look, if you know your Wenamun, then you know that her sister, Tanet Amun, was married to another Libyan warlord, Nesi Ban Ebjed, up in Tanis, this new city that's being founded, like a military base, if you like, because Pir Ramses is slowly silting up and moving away from the Nile. And you need a city that's right there on the Nile. And so she's working with family connections too to bridge the divide between North and South in a decentralized Egypt. So I would go with Nojmet and
she kind of gives
and all
off
that
like,
she brings with that her for this type for this place in the world that we are almost finding ourselves in. Let's talk after November about crisis and in the United States, and then you know we can discuss further.
Yeah, I'm so already so sick of all the election ads on television. It's awful. But Nojmet kind of reminds me of like a Cleopatra the Seventh, you know, last daughter of the last Ramessid king. This connector, but she has to play ball with, you know, a different group of people, right? Libyans versus Cleopatra's case of Romans.
And the other interesting thing about Nojmet's life is that women rule differently within patriarchies because they have to. They don't get to raise armies. They don't have professions. They have to work through the men. They have to make deals. And she seems to have excelled at making all kinds of deals and keeping the peace and keeping everyone together. And as soon as she dies, everything blows up. You get evidence of a banishment to the oases of a number of royal individuals or people connected to royal families in the north and the south. You get people brought back. You get Amenemnisut, her son, who dies after a very short reign. And that's associated with this banishment, it seems. You get a diminishment of power. Her son Panegym does claim kingship, but not in the way that Herihor claimed kingship. In some ways more than he claimed kingship, but there's less building. There's just less of the monumentality of rule for Panegym the First. And there is just a diminishment of the ideological trappings of rule in her absence. So once she couldn't hold on to this life anymore and succumb to the next world, she would have seen perched in her underworld place, wherever that is for the Egyptians, she would have seen everything going to shit that she had built, and how upsetting to, you know, put it all together and be like, okay, you know, we that was really difficult, that late 20th dynasty civil war bullshit and then more stuff. And there I've got it all figured out. And I've got, you know, one of my sons has become king. There's the other one who's become king. It's they're going to work together. And it doesn't seem that they do in her absence. So. Yeah,
I think like her and her sister as like dual point of views in a show would be really interesting, or like her later in life having like, you know, back and forth between when she was younger.
They're all tragedies. Every one of these women their story is a tragedy. And, you know, they hold the wolf by the ears. They can only hold it for so long until that wolf breaks free and then starts gobbling up the world around them. But each one is a vibrant story of triumph. And then a really quick, sad tragedy as all of that hard work is undone. So maybe I shouldn't step down from being chair of the department, Jordan. I don't know.
You probably shouldn't.
But I've got to. So it's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, yes. That's a different discussion. Mine would be, I think it'd be really cool, like a Sen and Mut and just like, daring point of views of like Hatshepsut, T3's court, but not focusing on whoever the king is at the time. Like very much they're off in the shadows, but like lower elites and what's going on, like more court intrigue, I guess, and Senenmut and all the new men she puts into power and kind of their negotiations and, you know, all these things. So I think that would be an interesting one for me.
Oh, very cool to see, you know, we call it an upstairs downstairs drama, a Downton Abbey type drama where they're downstairs and, you know, they mention the lord of the manor, they mention the lady of the manor, they mention the dinner party that they have to do or whatever it is. The Egyptians would have had the same elements as the key features of their story and the politics of what's happening upstairs. They don't really know. They just need to get the soup on and make sure that the beds are made and that everyone's happy. And it would be really cool to include that as well. So, yeah, I think so.
So HBO, just hit us up. What are you waiting for? Anyway, next question. Marissa asks, in parentheses, this question is based on a 4 a.m. random conversation with a friend. It's now 5 a.m. and I hope my tired brain can make some sense of my thoughts. So,
oh, dear. Oh, dear. Okay, so, go on.
Okay. Marissa, I'm thinking about colonialism and how it affects our study of different cultures. We know that Egypt had outside influences from the South, the North, Hyksos, and Greeks, to name a few. How do we define colonialism? Is it the same now versus then? And when do we include colonizers as part of our main populations? It's a very deep question for 4:30 in the morning.
I mean, this is when you should be asking such a question, I feel. So that's just fine. Look, I think this is hitting a key feature of why it is so very hard to talk about identity in Egypt today. Because as soon as you start to talk about, were the ancient Egyptians Black, for example, you can't get a hotter question than that that makes people's heads explode and they just lose their minds. We are Black, definitely. And Egypt used to be blacker. We aren't Black. Look at how white we are. And we never were Black, and don't take our history. And it seems as if there are two diametrically opposed sides. And in the social media, there are. But if you go and hang out in Luxor for a while, you hang out in Aswan, you hang out in Minya, or the Delta in Cairo, you'll get a very different understanding of how people understand identity. But colonialism is a part of everything. So do you then say, look, Egypt wants to be like maybe nationalists ruling Egypt right now, wants to be whiter because of British and French rule, you know, and colonialism. And you could say, absolutely, yes, that has created a marketing campaign where people are advertising for villas with, you know, a whitish, the whitest of white Egyptian families on the billboard celebrating a birthday in their swimming pool or something. And you drive by that billboard in Cairo and you look around and you see the faces are of a multitude of different shades, few of them as white as that. But so that's British French colonialism. Okay, that's one option. But it's way more complicated. You go back further in time and you say, well, what about the Arab elite replacement in the 7th, 8th, 9th centuries CE? You know, what does that do? What is a West Asian elite replacement, 10% of the population coming in and replacing a population that was there before? Not completely, not 100%, but in an imposed colonial way. How did that change Egypt? Well, it took language away. It took an indigenous language away that had been used for thousands of years, which really fucks with an identity. It really changes how you understand who you are and how you're associated with your land. It takes your religion away because now we have a new religion of Islam that is not imposed by point of sword, but with an elite replacement, really encouraged through peer competition and wanting to be part of that ruling elite as well. So more of a social mobility and interest in being part of the ruling groups. And so people changed to Arabic, changed to being Muslim in a way that they hadn't before. So they abandon their Christian Egyptian speaking ways in the first millennium CE. And then you're like, okay, so it was that. But wait, there's more. Because then you have, before that, you have a Hellenistic, Ptolemaic occupation and colonialism of the Delta in particular, but that, you know, it has roots down into the South as well. And you have these Greek-speaking peoples coming in and colonizing. Naukratis is a colony, and imposing the Greek language and creating, it, certainly in the North, an elite replacement as well. Such that people who wanted social mobility to be included in those money-making schemes needed Greek names, Greek language, Greek associations, and so associated themselves, whether they were Egyptian or not, with a Greek way. And you get, you know, toe tags of dead people that have demonic on one side, demonic Egyptian and Greek on the other, and people don't know who they are. And we talk about hybridity and code switching and such. This is going all the way back to, you know, 4th, 3rd centuries BCE. And then is that the end of it for the Egyptians? By no means. You can go back further, right? So let's go back to the Persian occupation and colonial settlements there, the taking of certain oasis lands and turning them into agricultural spaces, the building of temples, the use of elites, people like Uja Hrezna. Now, the Persians didn't settle there. This wasn't an indigenous rule. They were ruling from the Persian homelands, Persepolis, Asagarde. But what does it mean that this people from far West Asia are taking over? What does that occupation mean? It was a lengthy one, 27th dynasty, 31st dynasty, we would say, as Egyptologists. And that's going to mess with people's identities. But wait, there's more. You can then go back before that and you can talk about the sacking and razing of Egypt by the Neo-Assyrians and the Neo-Babylonians, who also don't settle, but then set up puppet dynasties. And wait, there's more than that. It's not colonialism exactly, what we see at the Bronze Age collapse around 1100 BCE. But what is it when a mass of people speaking different languages come into Egypt and bring their tribal names with them and then Egyptianize? These are men, like we were just talking about before, Pianchi and Herihor, who then come in and then, you know, they take power as warlords. They Egyptianize. That's a loaded term. And I understand what I did when I said it, that it's very problematic. I am not saying these new people have no agency to bring their own identities from their own side. But Egyptianization is a part of the process that they feel they must go through. Then after a certain amount of time, you know, they can name their kids Masaharta and other Libyan names, right? But and they retain the great chief of the Meshwesh as part of their titles. And we are confused, we Egyptologists, about whether Libyans are even sea peoples at all. I would argue that they are. Just some of the first wave, or people who settled to the West first and then came in from Libya, kind of like a Sheridan associated with Sardinia. But I think that these great waves of migrants aren't colonialism, but they change the identity of a people. And so you've just heard in, you know, 3 minutes, a very complicated, and I didn't get to the Hyksos. I didn't get to, you know, the stories of Exodus and such, and you know, the Syrian who made himself at the end of the Ramesside period. You know, there's no time. But in other words, there is no pure place. There is no boundaried place where people stay one thing and intermarry and have sex and babies only with the same type of people. There's always movements. There's always adaptations of identity and how we understand ourselves. And this is normal. So how Egypt then reacts to what their identity is perceived as being by different audiences is going to be colored by all of that. That's so much weight to carry, so much trauma that modern Egyptians all carry from millennia of people wanting to come in and claim Egypt, take it as their own, and such that people, you know, have a hard time talking about who and what they are, but they're still Egyptians. They're still Egyptians. And I reject anyone saying that you can only be Egyptian if you have the genetics of somebody who was Egyptian 2,000 years ago. That's bullshit. Or 3,000 years ago, or 4,000 years ago. It's ridiculous. And it's not the way human beings work. And it's not the way migration patterns work. It's such an astute question, because it's everything. And I think more things need to be called colonialism than not. And a dear colleague of mine just had a paper rejected by a French edited volume because they were claiming that the Ptolemaic regime was a colonial occupation. And this was so repugnant to the editors that they rejected the article. I could be overthinking it, that this was the reason, but I don't think so. So these things are still touchy, in other words, and people still have a hard time talking about it. This shit happened thousands of years ago, but it's still in our bodies. We still carry it. We still don't know what to do with it. And of course, I find that the most interesting thing in the world.
Yeah, it's interesting thinking about efforts to colonize Egypt, but also Egyptians colonized Nubia, I think very much so. And then, you know, Nubia came back and rolled over Egypt for a while. And then some people would argue that Egypt colonized into, you know, larger Palestine, Levant area as well. So the kind of back and forth. My one question is, you know, thinking about like defining colonialism, Does it always have to be like an imperial endeavor? Or that like colonialism with a big capital C has to be like somehow linked to empire? Because it seems like it often is. It's like imperial endeavors of spreading the empire. You have colonies. Because obviously, as you said, there's so much interaction going on just naturally. But colonialism seems very harmful. And I think we all acknowledge it's very harmful. But just normal interaction, cultural interaction is not harmful. So is the distinction really just between the goals of extraction and malignant use of whatever you're colonizing versus just a harmless interaction, trade, movements of people, migrations, and things like this?
It's such a tough question. I think that colonialism, however,
like when does cultural interaction become like a system?
Yeah.
Colonialism.
When it involves an unfair extraction of goods, resources, and labor and people.
And I guess power differential in most cases.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not saying that a mass migration of sea peoples wasn't destabilizing and didn't create an extraction of resources, but it didn't take those resources out of Egypt to someplace else or pull it into a hoarded space for the very few beyond those rulers who ended up taking control. It wasn't a concerted effort of one group of people who differentiated themselves in terms of culture, be it religion or language or ethnic identity or whatever, and then said, those things belong to us because those other people don't know how to handle it. And then create an ideology of denigration of usually indigenous people who can't manage their goods and resources, who aren't economizing their goods and resources. These other people coming in can do a much better job. And you create these ideologies of jobs creation and prosperity gospels and all kinds of things. I mean, prosperity gospels are much older than anything we're dealing with today. So, there are definitions of colonialism. I think we should look at them carefully. I think when we're working with it, we should say, this is how we define this thing. But colonialism is not the only way to create an elite replacement. It's not the only way to create differentials of power and to pull resources away from one group to another. But it is a way that is quite insidious because it splits one part of the population against the other. And many other people have written about this. You can read, like, go get a very short introduction of colonialism or something like that. But when a colonial power comes in, they have to work with people who are there. They have to co-opt. They have to get collaborators. So those people are then brought into the fold of the colonial master, if you like. They might learn the language perfectly. They might go abroad to get an education. They might marry into part of that colonial occupying group. And then if and when that colonial force is diminished, maybe it leaves. It doesn't always happen like that. They just leave. Like the French have left, part of Africa, Algeria, for example, or the British have left Egypt. It's not always so blatant and obvious. Sometimes it is, but maybe that power is diminished. And when that power is in whatever way diminished, then you get the people of the same land in a civil war against each other. The people who collaborated are hated and reviled by those people who did not or could not make those choices themselves. And then you have these battles between different ethnic groups, one who's associated with the colonial group and one who is not. And the other reason, you know, I wrote about this in The Good Kings, and I think about this all the time, that you and I are sitting here speaking a language of our, or let's start with writing a script. You know, I'm looking at the Zoom and I see my name there and I see your name there written in Latin letters that are the letters, the alphabet of colonial occupiers of Europe and Britain. And so if my last name is Cooney, okay, yeah, they didn't make it to the Irish island, but they got to Britain, and then the British colonized Ireland brutally. And so we all use these Latin letters from our Roman overlords who colonized so many in their imperial war machine thousands of years ago. Do we look at this alphabet and go, oh my God, those asshole Romans, and I will not use this alphabet, and how dare they? No, we use it. It's the most useful thing ever. And then you think of the Life of Brian clip. What has Rome ever done for us? And, you know, we're speaking these languages as we colonize the new world. And we're here speaking English, the language of the greatest empire that ever was on this globe, maybe minus American economic colonization with banks, et cetera, and the dollar. But that's it. Then it gets complicated, doesn't it now? So, you know, how do you talk about it? We're still extracting the fuck out of resources and hoarding them and controlling them, using our dollar to do so and putting people into extraordinary debt, penury, and austerity. But we may not call it colonization because we don't have boots on the ground. But colonization is insidious because the people living within it often cannot recognize it as such, cannot see it, cannot talk about it. Even if they do see it, how can you hate it? Because you end up hating yourself, because it makes everyone a collaborator. And disentangling that is impossible, which is why post-colonialism is a non-reality. There is no post. It's always just a new colonialism. And it's a constant ongoing reality of recolonization in some way. And so that, you know, it's a traumatic weight. That's what colonialism does.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot to unpack there for sure. And I think just ultimately, like, you'd have to get rid of power, because ultimately it's just ways of forcing your power over someone else and extracting resources and doing all these other things. So
colonialism, you know, is a patriarchal power tool, mm-hmm, par excellence. It's the way patriarchs think. That is the water in which we swim. Those are the people who hoard the resources. As part of this anti-patriarchal revolution, which I think we all find ourselves in, we need and are creating workarounds to such things. We're creating anti-colonial, anti-corporate, anti-hegemonic systems that help us survive. We're not doing it to fuck the man. We're doing it because we need childcare and the patriarchal colonial state is not going to give it to us. We need a socialism that works so that we can survive in this hard scrabble world in which to make rent, we have to work three jobs. I mean, that's the reality. So you could argue that private equity is the new colonist into everything in the American life. You think, oh, we're Americans, we get to colonize others. Well, watch out, because now you've got those same people colonizing your home, your food with Roundup and all kinds of horrible chemicals. They're colonizing your health and making your health bad and then selling you a drug that's super expensive. They're colonizing the clothes you put on your body, your everything from skincare, and they're colonizing the, you know, how ugly you feel with social media, and what they're colonizing your social lives. And now everyone's lonely and stays at home because they can't deal with the world. I mean, we're all holding such deep generational trauma of patriarchal colonization of the body, the land, and the mind, that I just don't even know what to say. So to survive, we must create workarounds that are anti-patriarchal, and what that looks like, we're just now seeing. And when you live in the patriarchy, how you come at it without patriarchy is hard to recognize. It's messy. It involves deal-making. It involves decentralized power. It involves including the patriarchs. They need to be healed too. And it's a very interesting time that we find ourselves.
On a very, she's like,
and she's like, oh my God, fuck this. I'm so done.
That's why I just read fun books to escape from reality.
That's why I read depressing books.
I can't.
I mean, that's super depressing, but I read books that are about the issues of the world. People like, I was saying to someone, I'm like, well, you know, because war is coming, and they look at me, they're like, how do you just exist in that brain of yours? I'm like, I can't not think
you thrive
of these
in the
things.
Chaos.
You can joyfully look at everything falling apart somehow, I think.
I'm glad you can. I'm glad someone can. I just, I need to step away occasionally. I'm sure you do.
I mean, let me put it this way. This is weird, but there is a part of the human being when say you're listening. Okay, there are some things I can't read. Like I can't read like the climate change stuff and how, you know, the whole world will burn. And I just am like, okay, climate's fucked. And I don't read those. I'm a social historian. I read about the human systems and what workarounds we might potentially have. But I think there is a part of the human being that's like, fine, fuck it. Let it all burn. Let's just get this over with. Let's just rip off the Band-Aid. Let's just have the movie moment where the whole world turns to ice or fire or both or whatever. And I understand that. There is a part of me that looks at these things and says, you know what? We get the government we deserve. We get the social system we deserve. This is what we've been creating. This is what we get. And now we get to see what we can do to change it. Los Angeles is the home of the homeless and filled with people muttering to themselves or screaming at other people with black legs and feet and matted hair. This is the world that we have created. And there's a part of me that's like, it will not change until we get to this, a worse rock bottom place. I'm not saying I'm joyfully looking at the abyss, because I'm not, but I am saying I don't want to keep what we have. And the only way to move to something else is to go through the fire. Maybe it's because I've been divorced and getting divorced blows up your life in such a horrible way. And maybe it's because I know so many people, so many friends were like, I can't do that. I can't do what you did. And I can't have my kid hate potentially or really hate me for a number of years and try to think long term about my relationship. I'm not going to do that. And so many people I know decide not to go down that path, or it's not bad enough, or whatever it is. And having done it, and having gone through it, and I really didn't have a choice at a certain point, but having gone through that, you can see that going through the fire can lead to a better place. And all of us are, this is what I wrote about in The Good Kings, we're all divorcing our patriarchal overlords, or we should be. And many of us are like, no, but they keep me so nice and I love it. And I can have a boyfriend on the side and it'll all be fine. And other people are like, what the fuck? And most of us just have our heads down because we're working so hard and we can't even figure out what's going on and we don't have the time or energy to think about it. But there can be something better on the other side. The problem is, it's not going to happen in our lifetimes. It's going to take too fucking long. It's going to take generations. And the generations of trauma that we study, that's what we study. We study generational trauma. And we study how it works upon people and how it creates new systems of generational trauma. And it's like we're historical psychologists, historical Freudians or something. And then it moves, but we are watching it morph and move into a really big shift in which the patriarch destroys his host. And how is that going to work? So in a way, I'm like, yeah, let's do this. Let's bring it on. I want to see what's going to happen next. I may not feel that way if all of my money in the bank, which is digitized, just disappears and goes someplace else. I probably won't. I probably won't feel that way if I can't get, you know, the things that I rely on shipped to me from China. If books can't get published, that books not getting published is less apocalyptic than some other things that I can think of, right? So, yeah. When things crumble, people suffer, and I will suffer too. It's not like I'm in some safe bubble space, and I think about those things as well.
But maybe easier to face it head on, prepared, than to let it happen to you, in a sense.
I am semi-excited about what we human beings could create as workaround. Let me put it that way. That's mm-hmm. as softly as I can state it.
Thinking about in the past, we have many examples of us being adapting to new environments, new circumstances, new systems. So if we have anything to go off of, is that we're very resilient and that will work. But as you said, things being so, taking so much time, you know, you have to lay the groundwork and hope the next generations still have the same vision and take it in the right direction that we hope it goes to. And not to some dictatorial,
state that when systems fall apart, people can act like assholes. But it is a patriarchal trope to say that when things fall apart and systems fall apart, that everyone becomes a racist, maniacal, hoarding, murdering asshole. That's patriarchy. That's the way the system works, actually. And we can see that in places like Gaza. We can see that in places like Ukraine, Congo, Ethiopia, Sudan. You know, you can see it in all of the places where the world is burning. That's what patriarchy is already doing. So when those systems like collapse so that they can't replicate themselves, if we could ever get to such a point, might we be able to create power sharing workarounds that aren't that kind of hoarding of resources or sex or women or children or slaves or labor? I mean, it's an interesting thing that the patriarchs have to go and buy an island and then build a fucking bunker because they know they've done something wrong and they know that people will come for them. That's interesting to me. And so I would never want to be one of those people or associated with one of those people. So I'm just going to live my outspoken life in the flats of Los Angeles, which is by no means safe as we stare down this abyss of patriarchal excess and the end game of what this patriarchal experiment has brought. That's where we are. It's going to take 100 years to figure it out, more than that.
I saw a funny meme and it was like the number of people who flew on private airplanes to Las Vegas for the Super Bowl. And it was like, and I'm just here recycling like my yogurt caps. It's like, no, okay.
But no one's going to fucking recycle because
exactly.
That
we just send it
too.
To Indonesia or something. Yeah. So on that note, the next question actually is related.
Oh, great.
Kristen asked.
Because I just was in my brain going into the colonization of all of us to make us recycle shit for the corporations so that they can keep producing this horrible plastic. But anyway, go on.
Don't worry. We'll just be wearing those like AI, new Apple AI, while like the world burning around us and inside our little Apple headsets, it'll be like trees exist here and just be little robots for the system.
Yeah.
Anyway, about climate change, Kristen asks, how much evidence do we have for extreme climate events in ancient Egypt? I know it very occasionally snows in the north, with snowfall ever recorded. What about extreme rains or flash flooding, extreme heat or cold? I know the inundations of the Nile are well documented, but outside of that, I'm curious about what other records we have.
I mean, there's so much, right? Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of earth movements and climate changes that are documented in the ancient world. And we could start with the fact that the Nile is a moving, living entity that changes course, that doesn't keep to a Army Corps of Engineered kind of canal. We just talked about Pyramzes having to be abandoned and a new city founded because the Nile abandoned it and there was no way to make it work as a naval strength. So that Egyptians knew they were on unstable ground because they literally were. And every season, most of the buildings and homes and shelters would be flooded and they'd have to be moved before the flood to high ground. People would all be squeezed together or, you know, on high ground or in places off it, in the desert beyond the inundation. So that idea that a land is on moving ground is cool. And it's something you don't see when you go to Egypt today because it is an Army Corps of Engineered kind of canal. This is the Nile. It shall not move. That is not the way it is meant to be. It is the way we have engineered it to be with our dams and all of that, which is patriarchal excess causing all kinds of damage. And now that there are three dams on there, the Nile is moving to the slowest of crawls, which is killing it. It is no longer a living, breathing ecosystem the way that it was. And, wow. You know, karma's a bitch.
But in that episode with Claire about agriculture, she talked about how the early Nile, it was so tumultuous. It kind of hindered people settling near it, and that the delta was like just a hot mess and like you couldn't do anything up there.
Yeah.
That it was just kind of like there was no land, it was moving around so much, and that it wasn't until later. And so it makes me think even about the like foundations of Egyptian, like north, south. You know, we have this idea of the south conquered the north. Of course, that makes sense too. If the land up there is not even kind of settleable and you're constantly moving around and you can't, you know, build up this like the South can, and that people coming into the Nile Valley was because of an extreme weather event, right? The drying of the Sahara early on.
I mean, how sad, Jordan, because you just talked about the elemental generational trauma of Egypt itself. And I know Egypt is an imposed name from the Greeks, so whatever you want to call it, Kemet, fine. But this idea of the colonization of the north by the south, of a bunch of wild people, hunter-gatherers, non-agriculturists, the harpoon people as represented on the Narmer palette, people with wild hair and unclothed bodies and just a different kind of culture. And that's then united. And those northerners become as civilized, and I use those scare quotes in our minds, as the southerners. But it starts, the state always starts with some sort of trauma. Mm-hmm. Always. And Egypt is the first regional state on the planet. And it may not have been like the Narmer Palette where they go in and have this great battle, and that's fine. But there is still information that there is an economic, cultural imposition of southernness on the north, and that you're creating this new space. I mean, I know we're supposed to be talking about climate change and all of this, but it's interesting that the Nile's geography itself can encourage this kind of hegemonic patriarchal colonization. Yeah.
You know, we have instances of really low Niles, really high Niles that obviously would have been super detrimental if they went on for years. Too much water is just as bad as not enough. Flash flooding is really still very common, right? So a big rainstorm out in the desert makes all those wadis are caused by flash floods.
Right.
So that's snow. So I actually did look up in the TLA instant attestations of snow. And then so the
is
word,
there words?
Oh my so God. The word for it, it's a Semitic loan and it's Zarek or Sock. And the only instances are, there's a couple like Ramses II, Ramses III, like Abu Simbel has a text talking about troops being in Palestine and it raining and snowing a lot. So they obviously knew of it in other regions, but there's no discussion of it happening in Egypt as modern day Egypt.
How cool. I just looked it up in, you know, the little little app. Mm-hmm. Put in the English where you can put in snow, and I get this word sock, and it has a crocodile and a water
so like
determinative
chaos.
With the canal. So it's like chaotic waters. That's awesome.
So obviously they knew about it, but I think probably, I mean, maybe it snowed in Egypt, but we don't have any, like, I know it just snowed in Alex the other, like last month, but obviously they knew about it in areas where it snows more. You know, up in Syria, Palestine type of areas.
And so, you know, in Sinai it can snow, but how, that's Syria for the Egyptians.
But I don't know about extreme cold or extreme, you know, we have like the Tempest Stela that talks about like a crazy storm, but whether that's recording a real event or not, you can see the article by Rittner and Nadine Moeller about that. Some people link it to, you know, the Theron eruption and that causing larger climactic issues, which I'm sure it did. Earthquakes too are known.
There's no volcanoes in Egypt, but there are, as you say, there are earthquakes. So I've never experienced an earthquake in Egypt. I've experienced one in California, only small ones.
Did you feel that recent one?
Yes, I was in the faculty center.
I was sitting right here. And, like,
and did everything shake? That was a big one.
I was home alone too. So I was like, Jeff was out running groceries. And I was like, what do I do? I'm by myself. And I was like,
the windows, it was the weirdest thing to see the glass like wave.
It was long.
Yeah, it was long.
I was just sitting here like waiting for it to stop.
Yeah. And there were little aftershocks. That was pretty crazy.
Yeah.
So you know, there are earthquakes in Egypt. Of course, you have the droughts that hit Egypt at the end of the Old Kingdom, first intermediate period.
4.2 EP event.
Yeah. And lots of discussion about that. And I would look to Ellen Morris for a lot of that. She's recently taken on a lot of the so-called pessimistic literature, which Egyptologists have been like, oh, this is all pure propaganda. It didn't really happen. And she's like, no, really happened. And you can have it happen too and be propaganda. And I don't see why these two things are mutually exclusive. And she's taken some brave stances on this work.
But so one of her main lines of evidence, I really like her work, is in Ottoman texts where they sent someone to Egypt because there was a drought happening. And this guy recorded what he saw. And it's like they're starving, they're eating their kids, and it's all like, he's not exact, it's not hyperbole. And so she uses that as like evidence, even within historic periods. We see the Nile, super detrimental droughts that cause people cannibalism, starvation, all these things. So why couldn't that have happened back then?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so many of these intermediate periods in Egypt that we scholars constructed using historical data are associated with climate change droughts. And those droughts could be elsewhere in the world, like in the third intermediate period, the Bronze Age collapse. Yeah, there's big climate changes, but a lot of those big climate changes, not that there's no drought in Egypt itself, there is in the 20th dynasty. There is evidence for grain prices being quite high. But there's also war and destabilization and people using that grain to feed armies and other things. But, you know, Egypt can be a haven. Egypt can be the place that people run to during a time period of extraordinary drought. From rain-fed agriculture, they can be coming from West Asia, Northwest Asia. They can be coming from Europe and the Northern Mediterranean and coming into Egypt, which then overruns Egypt, and it's a whole
problem.
Yeah,
and we have some of those Hittite letters of asking, like they're starving, they're asking for grain because Egypt more regularly has better grain storages because they're not relying on rain-fed. And this perfectly tees up our next question, actually.
I love it.
Which Matt asks, and so from our labor relations in ancient Egypt part two episode, you all say that during a period of austerity following the murder of Ramses III, construction projects in the Valley of the Kings dry up, slow up, right? Like the Deir al-Medina workforce gets cut down, and suggests the unemployed Deir al-Medina artists.
It's not quite that simple. It's not quite that simple, but go on. Yeah.
And suggests that the unemployed Deir al-Medina artists went back into the tombs that they or their ancestors built to reuse previously buried materials. So we start looting. You call this industrial scale reuse, suggesting substantial wealth put into play by a social class unused to having this much disposable wealth. How did these underemployed artists use this wealth? Was it invested in the community or individual family projects? Did the repurposing of tomb goods desacralize their religious beliefs?
Oh, these are very interesting questions. Yes. So starting with the first part, after the murder of Ramses III, kings are still buried in the Valley of the Kings. Their tombs are still pretty grand. So they don't abandon it completely. Valley of the Queens, I think work also continues there. And there is an increase in the workforce after the murder of Ramses III, actually, in which the workforce is like, it becomes 120 men. It's this massive workforce. Like they can't all have lived in the village. Insane. During a time period when the king's tomb needs to be finished very quickly, maybe Ramses IV. Ironically, the king's tombs at this time, Ramses IV, Ramses V, are shit or small. That shouldn't say shit for Ramses IV. That's mean. Or reuse, right? Ramses IV, V, we say. And then they let a lot of those workers go. And they're like, okay, we need you to take it from 120 down to 60. The choice is yours.
Oh,
holy shit. We can only imagine that. The crew at Deir al-Medina that day is everyone's trying to bribe the foreman to let their son stay or whatever it is that they're trying to create. But the wealth that people aren't used to having, I wouldn't put it that way. I would put it as wealth that people in society don't expect them to have, which means that they kind of have to hide it. There might be a flaunting of it. If you did that with reuse wealth from the tomb, you would be advertising that you have access to tombs to reuse, that you you only show your wealth if it serves you, right? So if you wear bling, it's to attract attention, to get people to come to you as a customer, or to show other power. But in the ancient Egyptian reality with Deir al-Medina, I would say that you had to hide that wealth. That newfound wealth as much as possible.
Well,
and
like
not talk about it.
The tomb robbery, we see like, you know, so-and-so got X amount of gold or whatever. And presumably, you know, yeah, they wouldn't go out and like buy a new house because everyone would be like, where'd you get this? You'd maybe slowly, you know, pay off some of your debts, slowly incorporate it. But yeah, maybe keep it on the DL majorly.
Yeah.
And I just pulled up an article by Benedict Davies about the number of workmen. Because as you correctly stated, like it goes up to 120 in year two of Ramses the Fifth, and then halving it. And it reminds me so much of like modern day companies like Disney going on this like hiring spree, increasing workforce. And then like next month they cut everyone, but then they're like investing $1 billion in this other thing.
Yeah.
And so just like the, we'll hire a bunch of people like short term, almost like seasonally, like when we need to get a tomb built. And then as soon as it's done, it's like, oh, we're going to lay off half of you because we don't want to continually employ in that way.
Yeah. And this is short term versus long term sorts of strategies by the ruling elite.
So, but can you speak to the desacralization? I think this is a really interesting idea. And this goes, I think, into your new book that's about to come out. You talk about this a lot.
Yeah, it's such an interesting question. How reuse and reusing coffins and taking one dead ancestor out of a nested coffin set and then removing that coffin set and commodifying it, reusing it, how that affects people's mindsets on religion, the sacred, the ancestor, the sacred ancestor, the Ahu. It's as interesting as you can possibly get. And I would say, yes, get Recycling for Death, because I talk about it there extensively, this idea of desacralization or the kinds of anxiety that this raises in people. You see some remnants of it in literature, like Khonsu Amhab and the Ghost, for instance. It's this wonderful tale that's only preserved in fragments, but it's this ghost of another priest that starts to haunt the current high priest of Amun. And he's like, really difficult, a very troublesome dead person. And finally, Khonsu Amhab is like, dude, what do you need? And he's like, I need my coffins. I need the things to make me feel safe. I need a home. And he gets him all of the best things. And then the ghost settles and everything's fine again. And you get an understanding of the deep anxiety that people had about taking wealth from the dead and what the repercussions would be to them, how the angry ghosts might come at them. And that's a weight to bear. But at the same time, when your loved ones die and they don't have any mechanism for transformation to become an Ahu or to be protected, then they're going to be angry ghosts that are wandering and pestering you for forever as well. So you have another problem. You have to take from the older dead who have been transformed to transform the recently dead. And it is your ethical duty to do so. So how are you supposed to traverse this minefield of different agendas from the dead? And then the most important thing, which, I think we can all understand that social competition, social mobility, social place is what's driving so many of these decisions rather than how we treat the dead. People need to show their best face, put their best foot forward. They need to show that their family has money and wealth. And if they have to reuse from their family sepulcher to do that, they will do so because they need to manufacture power. So, but, all kinds of fallout comes from these activities that people feel forced to make. And like one of them is the fact that it's at this time period, probably starting with Ramses III, Ramses IV, Ramses V, that elites start to really intensify. And it really peaks at the end of this period, like towards Ramses 9, 10, 11. That people really intensify the mummification of elites by putting in inlaid eyes so their eyes are open, by stuffing the skin of the face and the upper body, by adding false hair.
Like Najmet, right?
Like Najmet. Like
beautiful.
And
yeah.
Yeah, beautiful treatment of the mummy, plastering the face, putting on a beautiful skin tone, adding rouge and lipstick, in a sense, making them eternally youthful and making it wide open, an eyes-open effigy that can act and last like a coffin in the absence of a coffin. Because if everyone's coffin is being taken, then what are you to do in this anxious mind state that you're in, but make the part that people will not steal, won't steal, don't want to steal, the body itself, and to turn that into a coffin? It's one of the most clever adaptations that you can possibly imagine. And it's the the crisis of reuse that creates that adaptation. And as soon as reuse starts to decline, or obvious reuse and regularized reuse starts to decline, I'm not going to say the 22nd dynasty, they don't reuse, they certainly do, but there's less of it. That kind of tricked out mummification, that intensified mummification ceases as well. So it's super interesting. You can write books about it, and I have. You can also check out my Coffin Commerce for a discussion of what materiality does to us. Because you're asking about sacralization, and I would remind you that this is all stuff. I'm not saying there's not ritual attached to it. I'm not saying there's not fervent religious belief. There is. But it's still manufactured things that the elites are using to separate themselves from everybody else. It is a social separator par excellence. And the elites have created a system in which their dead are more sacralized than the other dead. And so that's part of what's breaking down, is the elites are trying to keep up with this social separation, and they're not necessarily able to do it, but they do everything they can to maintain it. And it's as much about social place as it is about sacred ritual, as it is about mummification and beliefs of where the dead go and things like that.
Yeah, like what might appear to us as desecration, you could easily swing into veneration or, you know, these other things. So I think we have to be careful with projecting our ideas onto the past, right? And
yeah, like
when the new St. Peter's was built and they had to destroy the old one, you could view that as desecration. They destroyed this old church, but they built a new one using bits of the old one. So, you know, these things are, but it was to venerate and to make something better and to preserve and to do all these things. But in a way, it's also desecration. So,
and people don't think that. They go there and they're like, Michelangelo, he was, you know, the architect of this site, and this is so beautiful. And look at this Bernini altarpiece. And oh my God, these people were geniuses. But when these things were happening, they were destroying antiquity, deep antiquity of the church that had been there previously, the Basilica Roman that had been there previously. This is the Roman Catholic Church, after all. Mm-hmm. And to put up something in, you know, the 1500s, 1600s, and it seems old to us, but...
Mm-mm. Have you been down to the catacombs?
I haven't been to the catacombs at the Vatican, but I have been to many other catacombs. And I've gotten a peek down into the St. Peter burial area, but not beyond.
Yeah, we went when we were there last... We scheduled a tour with the
That's awesome.
Archaeological office, and it's a Roman cemetery that's just they built on top of, and St. Peter's tomb is down there, and in his bones, and they just built a basilica on top of it, and you can see parts of the old basilica, and then they built the new church, so you can see all the layers. But
it's so funny. I just bought a book. I have all these books I'm going to read my sabbatical. They're just fucking lined up. But I have one that's called Christianity Death Cult. And it's you say that, I'm like, oh my God, it's so true. Christianity Death Cult.
Oh, yeah.
Eat my flesh, drink my blood, here, worship among the dead.
I'm not raised very religiously, was asking Jeff last night about like yesterday was Ash Wednesday, and then, you know, Lent starting, all this stuff. And I was like, what even is Ash Wednesday? And, you know, the spreading of ashes and, you know, beginning of Jesus's wandering in the desert and then to his death and all this stuff. So yeah, it's interesting. God can die and be reborn.
Yeah, very Assyrian. And you can imagine.
I was about to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. With the name Kathleen Mary Cooney, I would be that kid that would go to school on Wednesday with a big smudge on my forehead. Yes, that was the way. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Our last question. We'll finish it up. We have a question about a very current event topic. So Marissa asks, saw a post on Facebook by Salima Ikram about the reconstruction, rebuilding of Menkaure's pyramid.
Yeah.
And Marissa's wondering, you know, our thoughts on this. Obviously, there's been a lot of, if you've been, you know, kept up to date on this topic, there's been a lot of criticism, and they have since pulled back the project. But essentially, Menkaure's pyramid originally had granite lining the base of it, and they were putting back granite. It's unclear. I don't know if you know how much of it was like original granite that had fallen off and they were just kind of putting it back into place, or they were adding new granite. I think some of the image. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I would say I don't think anyone knows because no one studied it, right? To know which granite has fallen off and which granite was quarried away in medieval times to build Fustat, or which granite, you know, was left in place when Menkaure died and they didn't put on there. We don't know because no one, Menkaure's tomb has been carefully studied. It's a Reisner expedition. Lots of things were found, but I don't think anyone has done a study of the granite blocks. That would be a careful study. You would have to see which blocks were dressed, which blocks had elements on it to be placed in as a casing stone, which blocks show that they'd maybe been removed and things whacked off so that they could be hauled off to some other place. That kind of systematic, careful attention to architectural detail hasn't been done. And I think that's the problem, right? That's why, and you know, maybe that's what Waziri had planned to do, that he's deciding, okay, we're gonna do all of this careful work and put it back into place. The problem in my mind is that he said that he was planning on it led with restoration rather than leading with study. The study was a part of his discussion on Instagram, but it wasn't what was leading it. It was, we're going to put all of these blocks back. And make no mistake, if we went to Karnak Temple in 1812, all of those columns would be, not all, but most of them would be down all over the ground. And there was a certain point when the French mission decided to start putting them back up. Are those columns in the wrong fucking places? Yes, they are. Ask Peter Brand, and he'll tell you about how those columns are in the wrong fucking places. And that you used to be able to examine the breaks in the column drums, see how they did not fit, see how some columns were actually put in place upside down. And those have since all been restored and new materials added to all of those cracks between the column drums to make perfectly smooth columns. Maybe not perfectly smooth, the pretty names. So that you can't study that anymore. You can't see how Karnak Temple has been put back in a way that is actually wrong. I'm not saying that we go in with all of our cranes and take Karnak apart and put it back properly. But, you know, you could do it. It could happen. Ifao and Egypt has the cranes. They could do it. So why create a restoration that makes that kind of work nigh impossible, or people feel that it must be undone? Why put these granite blocks back into place when you don't really know where they belong? And can one ever know where they belong? So maybe AI would help with this, some sort of 3D mapping.
Yeah, I can imagine. Scan and
yeah.
I just feel like it's a practice of a bygone era, right? You think of Knossos, them kind of just like reconstructing Knossos very inaccurately with cement and all these things. And, you know, early reconstructions of Egyptian temples. I feel like the trend has now gone to like leaving things as it is until we have the technology and techniques to reconstruct them better. I know
I would disagree and say that we're still restoring coffins, for instance, within an inch of their lives.
Yes,
and doing more and more of it.
And statues being put back together. There's that whole new project in Karnak of the massive statue that they're trying to reconstruct out of bits and pieces.
Jordan, your St. Peter's analogy is perfect. There are times in the world when the leaders, whether they're leaders of Ministry of Antiquity, leaders who are the president of Egypt, both are interested in restoration to perfect and make things into a wholeness that was a broken antiquity, something that was a fragment, it was a ruin. They're making it into something that was more than it was. And other leaders have done this around the world, and you could argue that's exactly what the Pope was doing in Rome. He wasn't taking the ruins and perfecting them. He was tearing them down, retaining what was there below the ground as antiquity, carefully retaining that and then building something new on top of it. But you get these time periods like Karnak Temple when Amenhotep III is like, I don't need this festival court of Thutmose I anymore. I know we've used it for like nigh on 500 years, but really it's old, passe. I'm done with it. Bulldoze it. done. I want something new. I'm putting the pylon there. It's going to be fucking awesome. Wait till you see it. And he bulldozes over. No, he doesn't have a bulldozer, dear listeners. But he just raises to the ground a sacred spot that was probably in disrepair and not always nice looking. Who knows? They had to repaint it or whatever. And he's like, no, we're doing it. We're doing it new. And this is the time period that Egypt finds itself in, when everything needs to be new and shiny, hence the new capital, hence the gem of the Grand Egyptian Museum. You know, this old colonial space is not good enough. We need a new colonial space built with West Asian capital, Chinese capital, Japanese capital. You know, it's a tricky question.
Well, and like, but what brings in tourists, right? Tourists maybe don't really want to walk around in a bunch of ruins that don't really look like anything. What brings in tourist dollars? Things that look, that help you kind of reconstruct past better, right? Knossos still is a huge place people love to go see. Oh, look at the throne room. Look at this. Look at that. Even though it's not accurate at all. I don't know if tourists really care that much.
I love it. But the agency of some objects is mm-hmm. palpable. And these pyramids have agency over us. These pyramids, we didn't need me on the Today Show or Monica Hanna saying that this restoration would be a desecration. People were shocked. Mm-hmm. They're like, how dare you? Kind of like that restoration of the Italian Jesus, right? We could put it in the show notes.
Oh,
for Italian Jesus.
Yes.
But like, not that, you know, that object doesn't necessarily have the same kind of agency by any stretch of the imagination, but if we decided to go in and restore, I mean, Monica Hanna said it best. She's like, it's like making the Leaning Tower of Pisa upright.
Yeah,
what the hell are you doing?
Yep.
People are going there because it's leaning over. They're mm-hmm. going there because it's a mistake. It's like correcting the bent pyramid and making it, you know, mm-hmm. straight sided or something all the way up. It's taking like, away the
beauty,
how the object speaks to us.
Yeah, yes. I can see the ages on it. Yeah, so you don't want it to look perfect and new.
Yeah. But if you wanted to restore I can imagine the Egyptian state doing this, building a pyramid and cladding it in white limestone and doing it. You know,
kind of cool just to see what it looked like.
It
just
would
have
be.
It as like a separate piece.
Yeah,
but don't
or we can go to the Bass. We can go to the Bass Pro Shop in Memphis. That's always there.
That's true.
I don't know how big it is in comparison, but, you know, there are other people who have built such things. And it's just interesting that the pyramid itself was like, no, don't you dare. It's like he took on too big a titan, that one.
And Cowrie was like, think again. I'm the reject one, but don't touch me.
And people want to talk about Egypt all the time, but when it's something more nuanced or in the weeds, like even the city of the Golden City, you know, with the walls, the serpentine walls and all of that. But, you know, people didn't really get it. It was too big for them to understand. It didn't draw the same kind of attention, though you and I are like, holy shit, look at this place. But, you know, the pyramids, you don't mess with the Giza pyramids. People, their eyes turn and they're like, what are they doing? Who's doing what? This is the only standing wonder of the world left. You don't mess with that. And it seems people would rather keep it as it is, which is interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting, very telling. But okay, so that's our questions for this month. Thank you all for those. I will say next month's Q&A will be a live event that got sent out. So if you can attend, please come with your questions. If you cannot attend, send your questions in and we can read them live on the air. And we will record. And so if you can listen to it after as well. And we're looking forward to that.
Yeah, now's your time to be a paid subscriber. Get in there. It's like $5 a month or whatever. You get to be a part of all of our live events and you get to ask questions for our Q&A and be a part of the community in, you know, a more connected way, which is pretty cool. And we are growing. We get too many questions now and we'll see how our next live event, it's a Saturday, how that goes. We'll see how that goes. And it's always super fun.
Good to see everyone's faces and everything.
Yeah.
And on that note, this is
Afterlives of Ancient Egypt.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you to our listeners for your support, and please subscribe. If you enjoyed the show, share it with all your friends, and most importantly, leave us a 5-star review. Send all those ancient world questions and topic suggestions for future episodes to ancientnow@substack.com. We actually do read them all. You can find info on all my books, articles, and upcoming lectures on my website. Just head to karakuniegyptologist.com. Amber puts all of that together. Oh my God, thank you, Amber. Check out our Substack, Ancient Now, at ancientnow.substack.com, where we share perspectives on all that history and archaeology news every week and continue the conversations that happen after the podcast mic is turned off. Support the show by becoming a paid subscriber at our Substack Ancient Now community. This keeps the show free for everyone, and paid status gives you access to our archives. Thank you to our current supporters. I'm at all the social medias. Look for at Kara Cooney. Thanks to the team at Patina Productions for this podcast, which I must point out is wholly separate from my academic work at UCLA. See you next time on Afterlives of Ancient Egypt.